sort of a family discussion. We, my website, of course, is visited largely by people that I'm working on, you know, and this stuff is too easily excerpted to make it look like you're being manipulative, or, and we'll talk about looking conspiratorial this tonight. Whenever this is, it's a busy season, and that was I wrestled with this, and so far I don't think I will, but I'm trying to tape this, and the syllabi will be, hopefully we can sell the system or distribute it through the Discovery Center, so it'd be available to other people, and we may teach more sessions of it later in the year as well. That's I've been agonizing about that, but I think that's probably the way that I'd like to approach this. Now, if you'll open up to the course description, the very first one, I'm going to take you through this before we jump into the syllabus. And I'm going to read this and try to unpack this a little bit. The course description is, this course is designed for the active Christian who spends most of the work week within an office setting. Okay, so if you spend 3 days a week or whatever in an office setting, so you're around people that you have relations for, this is for you. I don't have that scenario in my life anymore. I now work at home. I don't even telecommute anymore. I literally am self-employed working at home. And so it's more some of this I will not be able to use for a while in the same sense that I have been able to do it when I was in an office setting, because we'll talk about frequency of contact as being important in this. It is designed to develop the skills and comfort level for sharing. Okay, in a gracious, gentle, and non-offensive ways. The precious story of the love of God and Jesus. We're trying to develop the skills and comfort level. I remember as a young college student, right after giving my life to Christ, I was a senior at the time, I read a book called something, had one of those great soul-winning titles by C.S. Lovett. And he said, I'm going to show you that there is a spiritual dimension. There's a spiritual warfare dimension to witnessing. He says, I want you to take a track, a gospel track, and I want you to go and try to leave it on a toilet seat in a restroom, okay, where you're just going to sit on the back, and it's closed in the stall kind, you know, in the stall seats, where nobody sees you. And you go and try to do this and see if you do not feel a fear and a nervousness and an opposition to do that, right? And I remember trying that and feeling that. Now, subsequently, I know that not all of that is spiritual warfare. A lot of that is very good sense to not do this if it's in the office that you work, for example, and they know, Glenn's been at it again. You know, here's the weirdo. You know, so there are times that this is appropriate, times that it's not. But there is that very definite element about comfort, and we want to get to where it's a natural thing for us to share our experience and our relationship with God. The skill aspect about it, we'll talk about with the horrible examples that we open this with. We've got two comical scenarios where you'll see where the skill issue is part of it. And gracious is fairly obvious. Gentle and non-offensive ways. We're not trying to build, for example, we're trying to build skills here. We're not trying to get more people on the unemployment rolls by teaching them how to share their faith at the office, okay? So there are elements here. Nor for you to be passed up for promotion. God does need people in management, believe me. And so we have to talk about these kinds of things as we go through. This is a practical course involving homework, occasional low-level role-playing, and writing assignments. This will not be an embarrassment class. We won't have people stand up or you bring people from your office for us to practice on. We won't be doing those kinds of things. But we will be we'll be practicing at home in your mirror. And so a lot of the assignments are for you to work out your way of saying something that fits your style instead of Glenn's southern drawl, okay, and things of this. And then you'll practice it in front of the mirror, which is intimidating enough as itself. That's a separate problem, okay? But we're going to work on practical skills here instead of just the pure theory of the work of salvation. Because you can get that in my forum class in the Sunday mornings where we got lots of theory. Lots of theory. Practical course homework. Topics will include how this is supposed to work, which we're going to cover tonight. The impact of lifestyle and some challenges for the Christian in the office. Creating situations in which sharing is comfortable and appreciated by the people that you talk with. See, we're trying to do... There's an old statement that evangelism is nothing more than one beggar telling another beggar where to find free bread. It's just that. And it's one of the responses we have that you'll see as we get through in this, like when they say, well, you're just trying to make me a Christian. You know, if you get this kind of response, one of the things you're going to point to, but yeah, obviously I would. If I found a great financial investment, I'd tell you about it too. Or a great restaurant, I'd urge you to go see it and try the veal. And I would expect you to do the same for me. If you found some really good deal as my friend or as my associate, I would expect the same thing. And so there's a model here of something that's appreciated that we're trying to get because it's coming out of an interest in their lives. And warm, we're going to have turning good works into good words. This will be one of your main challenges. The brighter your light shines, I remember somebody teaching one time that said, if you only do good works, but you don't let anybody know where they come from, you get all the credit. Right? If you only do good words and you don't have any good works, you don't get any. Nobody gets any credit. We take another hit. Christianity takes another hit. So we got to have a way of turning the good works words that works into words, and we've got a couple of ways of doing it. But that's one of the topics: finding opportunities. Where do you find where God is working in somebody's life? How to not sound religious when you share. One of the biggest issues that we've got in Silicon Valley is, man, you pop a couple of religious words out there and you're out. It's just gone. You're just, you know, you're branded fanatic. You lost it all. And what's worse, you don't mind getting branded. Branded is a separate problem than not having a clue. I remember when I first get into the consulting business, I was doing a software development. This would have been 1980, 81, after a career in MIS. And I remember I did some work for a Jewish investment firm. They did offshore investments at the Cayman Islands, where you couldn't trace it. And they were brilliant at it. And the head guy, Moses somebody, right, had a little plaque on his thing, a wooden carving, and it says, Jesus saves, Moses invests. Okay? And I remember thinking about that, about saves doesn't mean the same thing in that sentence, in that phrase, that I would have thought when I would say, yes, Jesus saves, right? And you've seen the old T-shirt in the 70s, Jesus saves green stamps, right? But the skeptic community had a T-shirt like that in the 60s. Jesus saves green stamps. And so saves doesn't mean the same, you know, it has a fluidity of meaning that counts against us. So if you pop some kind of religious terminology out there, not only do you lose in this process, but sometimes it doesn't communicate at all either. And so we've got literally a translation table in here, by the way, of old-style religious terms that we use here in church, and wonderfully so. Some of these you should fight and die to keep in your vocabulary. They're too beautiful. Okay, when you sing the hymn about there is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's vein, and sinners plunged beneath that flood lose all their guilty stains. Right? If you do it right, you can't say that with a straight face. But you try that on somebody in the office, yeah, a fountain filled with blood, gross! You know, this is really hideous.
Especially in the Baptist.
Okay.
Gross,
man. You know, I mean, they're precious to us, but sometimes you have to speak the language of the people you're trying to reach. It's like a translation, right? So, that's not religious, developing your story, which is your experience of Christ. Okay, what you know about Him, what you have seen in your life. Dealing with problems and objections, we'll spend some time on that. What to do when they say yes, I'd like to trust Christ. What would they do when they say no, I'm not ready. Okay. The emphasis is developing your own personal style of sharing your experience, okay, of the good-hearted God with others, in a way that generates respect from your co-workers and honors the Lord. See, you'll have, for most of the scenarios that we face, I've got written out already in the syllabus three or four different ways that I would say it, depending upon your style. And none of those will work for you. God will guarantee that. Trust me. If you try memorizing those suckers, He will just teach you not to do it that way. But what you'll do is then you'll go back in one of the assignments and you'll flesh that out your way, one of those in your idioms, because you don't have to adapt a Southern American accent like I've got to do this, right? Many times, I remember the first time I gave a public speech in the computer, when I lived out here in Silicon Valley. When I moved out here, I went back to Boston and made my first presentation outside of the southern United States. And as soon as I said the word five, okay, I got docked about 30 points of IQ in Boston. Just they wrote me down because of regional stereotypes, right? And so it's going to be important for you to develop your style, because it's going to have to look like it flows from your life, because it's going to have to flow from your life. And so that's going to be your idioms. You won't use the expression necessarily that I express in this. So that's basically overall where we're trying to go. And let's jump into page one. Introduction. Colossians 4, 5. Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders, and make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be always full of grace. See, it requires wisdom to do this. We'll talk a lot about what wisdom is. Wisdom is pure and is peaceable. It's gracious, it's kind, and it's appropriate. And I've got two vignettes that perhaps aren't the best examples of this. So let's read about Joe and Joan. Joe was moved by the sermon at the church service on Sunday on winning the lost. He decided that he would do everything in his power to get the gospel out to all his co-workers at ZYW Technologies, Inc. On Monday, he dressed in his normal middle management suit and tie, loaded up into his compact car, and drove the 45 miles to work. You can see this is a Bay Area scenario to drive the 45 miles to work. Okay. But once there, his daily routine changed for the sake of the lost. For over the weekend, Joe had made a sandwich board to wear over his suit as he walked in the office. Now, for those of you who don't know what a sandwich board is, sandwich board are two big sheets of wood with something connecting them. You put it up over you, like those repenter perish or doomsayers that walk the streets, theoretically walk the streets of New York City. This is how the stereotype is. And it's got Eat at Joe's or, you know, something at the back, and that's called a sandwich board. And you put it on over, and it's like a sandwich kind of thing. So Joe had made a sandwich board to wear over his suit as he walked into the office.
Can you make these up? Is this real?
No, I made these. Well, most of these I made up. I had not seen a sandwich board in a Silicon Valley office yet. That's encouraging. But I haven't looked everywhere either. That's a separate problem. Sandwich board. He knew that only doomsayers and weirdos wore this, but he was prepared to be a fool for Christ from now on. On one side of the sandwich board, the front side, was printed John 3:16 and "Ask Jesus in today." On the bottom. And on the back was the more forceful "Repent or perish," followed by a couple of Bible verses on the final judgment. So Joe got out of his car, put the sandwich board on over his head, grabbed his briefcase, and entered the building from the front lobby, so maybe some visitors might see and get saved too. To make sure that everyone saw this, Joe had arrived early so that he had ample time to walk up and down each aisle of cubbyholes instead of his normal straight route from the employee entrance to his cubicle. Once at his desk, he removed the sandwich board, of course, and went to work. But at lunch, he put it back on again and wore it to the company cafeteria during the lunch break. He sat by himself and prayed audibly, but not too loudly, for everyone that walked past him as he ate, praying that they would read the sign and believe in Jesus. He repeated the process as he left the office for home that afternoon, feeling quite good that he had proclaimed the gospel to his co-workers, and firming his resolve to do so daily until revival broke out throughout all of ZYW Technologies, Inc. Okay. Now, Joan had just come back from a woman's breakfast, in which a missionary from overseas had presented amazing stories of people responding to God's love in the mission field. She decided to make a fresh commitment to witnessing to others. She had witnessed three times back in college with the little pamphlets. And she decided to claim Hiatech Insurance Company for Jesus. HTI had some 500 employees at headquarters where she worked, and she felt committed to confronting all of them with the claims of Christ consistently and persistently, in love, of course. Joan decided to use modern means to reach all the people of HTI, and so every morning at work, she did two things. First, she did a copy-all email to all employees explaining how Jesus died on the cross for the wickedness of sinful people, and that by believing in Jesus as Lord and Savior, everyone in the building could go to heaven when they die. Gosh. She even had a few Bible quotes from the King James Version in the email to harness the power of the Word of God in giving new birth to the people who read the email. Then she used her second wave of daily attack. She sent a copy of a gospel tract from the local Christian bookstore in the inner office mail to every employee in the company, including those without access to email, just to be sure there were no unreached peoples here at HTI. She varied the tracts month by month to accommodate different reading levels. This took a long time, of course, so she stayed late every day to make sure she got her work done. But at the end of the day, she went home confident that the seed had been sown and that the gospel was getting out to her mission field. She is praying now about expanding the reach by leaving evangelistic voicemails for every employee every night. Now, is there anything wrong with zeal, according to Apostle Paul? It has to be according to knowledge. It has to be according to knowledge. Is there anything really wrong with the theology going down here? Not a whole lot. There's a little, but not a whole lot. It's basically on target from that standpoint. But what is missing is obviously the gentleness and appropriateness of what we do, the wisdom aspect of sharing. Okay. Some of these, by the way, do come from, not the sandwich board, but there are people that have done the emails that I know of. And then there are still, at least in America, and you can get away with it in some places, but it would be less appropriate here, people that have the little trucks that drive around in the neighborhoods with the little loudspeakers that preach, and they just drive up and down every city of the street. I have seen these in the last 2 or 3 years, still out in America. And in some places, guess what? That's completely appropriate. That's completely appropriate in some places. In some places out here, it'd be the kiss of death. They would look and say, another Jesus one. Gosh, how did they get this far? Wrong neighborhood's a separate problem. Right, exactly. Okay. And those are examples of what we're not trying to do, in case some of you were wondering if that's what I'm going to teach you all how to do. And so you decided not to come back to subsequent classes, that I've got the right tracks picked out and the right kind of copy of the emails I'll forward to you that you can distribute throughout, things of this type. So with that background, let's move into page 2, goal and method. And we're just going to try to get through 3 pages of this material and some other material tonight. The first is goal and method. Our goal here is to show them the good heart of God. These are our office workers. To show them the good heart of God as seen in the work of Christ in history and in our lives, and to encourage them to approach that God so that God will do His saving work through their interaction. All right, now let's unpack that. To show them the good heart of God. We are interested in them knowing that this is about love, that the cross is about love. When Jesus shares the gospel in John 3:16, He starts out with, "For God so loved the world that He sent His only begotten Son." See? In other words, there's a context that we're trying to show them that this is about something good. Remember, the word evangelize comes from evangel, which means good news. The U, the front, the EU is good. Angelos, the good announcement, basically. So if somehow the message, when we give the gospel to somebody, if it's bad news, okay, we've not done it right somehow. Okay. Now, it may have a negative effect on them. We will talk about those people that it has a negative effect on. Okay. So the gospel doesn't always have good results, but it is always good news, because it doesn't make exceptional demands on us. It offers us a number of things of this type. But the first part is we want to show them. We're trying to display this, not just tell them, but trying to show them the good heart of God. And the good heart of God is shown in this particular case in 2 places in our method. The first is in the work of Christ in history. So what did Christ do in history? There are 2 big ones that He did. One was the cross. And the second one He did was the transformation or institution of the church, transformation of the disciples. It is still amazing that the people of the original disciples could end up the way they did in terms of their character, their love. It is one of the most powerful testimonies of the reality of this faith is what happened to the original disciples. They died for this individual when they didn't have to, and characteristics that were very belligerent turned out to be very, very loving. Those that were impatient turned out later to be gentle and kind. If you look at John, if you compare the disciple John, for example, in the Gospels, John and James are called sons of thunder because they are angry people. They are not received well by the Samaritans, and they come to Jesus and they ask Jesus, "Do you want us to call fire down from heaven upon these people?" You know, this was the appropriate response. And Jesus just looked at them and just said, "You don't know what you are." You know, it was just a shock thing. And this is the person that wrote 1 John, the Epistle of Love, that where the greatest theme in that is just love. If you don't love your brother, you can't love God. If you love. You take the Apostle Peter. Apostle Peter in the Gospels is the most rash individual, almost braggadocio, you know, of that, you know, I will never deny you. You know, he's always overcommitting. He's speaking way too soon. And this is the person that writes the thing about the patience and gentleness of Christ in 1 and 2 Peter. Just a completely separate individual. Counsels elders to be patient and be slow, but be alert. Okay. And so these transformations, and then they all died for this thing. They all died for these, all except with the possible exception of the Apostle John. All the indications we have is that they died violent deaths, martyr deaths, for this individual. Yes?
So a question, the work of Christ in history, I might have expected the work of God in history, because I might have included creation as
right.
Trying to draw a distinction?
Yeah, I'm trying to focus it. Because one of the things that when Paul will go is that he will sometimes lead with creation occasionally. He'll talk about God's goodness. He gives rain and stuff like this. But he'll always come back that the power of the gospel is the cross. Somehow it's there that we see the both. The cross focuses our awareness, the fact that we can't do this and that God had to do it. In other words, most of the other aspects of religious experience have an element of ambiguity to them. Good works, living good. They can either be seen as a way to earn your way to heaven or as a gracious response to God's already doing something. But when you just stand before the cross and there's nothing to do, you can't take him down, you can't stop this, all you can do is be honest with it. It focuses a number of issues there, and that's where you see the love of God was manifested there. And so it's much more of just a clarity issue. We'll talk about this next phrase about in our lives, and it's still going to be what God is doing in our lives, so it's a little more general there. Because what we're delivering here is less a message. If you look at that next phrase, this course is about relationship evangelism, not broadcast evangelism, even though both are important. This is not where I'm going out and I'm doing what I call over the border runs. I'm running into enemy territory and trying to snatch some out. This is not where you're buttonholing people when you're witnessing to a cab driver that you don't know. This is our broadcast evangelism, where you're writing things for the web or things of this type. Now, perhaps the lady with the email was doing broadcast evangelism, but something of this type. But we will, in the case of relationship evangelism, it will be the reality of the message, and I'm a witness to this. It's changed me. Okay? Because the original disciples, as we'll see in just a minute, nobody had Bibles. There were no tracts. There were no Bibles. So your original apostles and disciples, right, when they go out, there's nothing to hand out. No little four spiritual laws. There's nothing to work with. The witness is, I saw it. It changed me. Right? And so what we're trying to do here is focus something that is not commonly known. For a first century apostle to walk around in Jerusalem and say, he changed me. Everybody knew then what they were talking about. Who we're talking about? Jesus and the recent crucifixion. It was on everybody's lips, is what the gospel writers say. And so those two elements about what happened there and how it affected me is what our message basically is. I can vouch that this is real because, hey, it changed me. Doesn't answer all the philosophical objections, and we'll talk a little bit about those. But our basic thing is what God has done through Christ, because our experience of God, well, everybody's experience of God, but has always been mediated through Christ. Just we didn't know it was Him until He actually showed up. We weren't aware of the theological dimensions of the Old Testament until later. So, good question. And that's basically where it's largely a focus. And part of it is pragmatic, but some of it is also is simply obedience. At some level, our command is to spread the gospel, per se. And the gospel, as we'll look at when we get to the context section in a couple of weeks, focuses upon that God wants people to be honest with Him about what His Son did and who His Son was. He went to a lot of trouble to do that for us. So good question. So our goal is to show them the good heart of God as seen in history, in the work of Christ in history on the cross, and the work of Christ in our lives, what He's done for us, be it a short period or a long period in our lives, patterns, and we'll talk about identifying those as we get in here too. And to encourage them to approach that God. Now, see, this is our job. I mean, we show them the good heart of God and say, why don't you go there too? Why don't you approach that God? Let me encourage you. I can't lead you there. I don't do the saving here. It's not what we do. We can talk about he that winneth souls is wise. Okay? And that's just a winsomeness kind of win. It's not so much a matter of arguing somebody into the kingdom, although it has been done, but never in the presence of a human. God won't apparently let us win an argument and lead them at the same time. It has to get us out of the picture so that people start thinking about the data and they have an encounter with God. It's the C.S. Lewis thing. And kicking and struggling into the kingdom of God. So, we're going to try to encourage them to approach this God so that if they start an interaction with God, if they start interacting, if they start the dance, they'll fall in love with this God. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get them to interact with this God, and everything from, I don't know much about you, right? But you helped my little buddy Glenn here some 25 years ago, some 12 months ago, 2 days ago. You helped him. And so, let me ask you. I'm hurting here. I have a need here. You know, you're really fuzzy. You're really non-precise to me. But that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get these people to interact with this God so that God can channel His saving work and His wooing through those interactions. See? And this is not, you know, arguing somebody in the kingdom or, you know, having more facts apologetically than they do or not even a fear. We'll talk about the fear motif as we go through the different reasons that people do this. Okay, so that's our goal. That's where we're trying to go for this type of evangelist. Now, some of this will also work in those other types. A lot of the explanations will work when you see good evangelists get up and have evangelistic breakfasts where business people come to the thing. You'll see that their terminology will more be like ours. It'll be more contemporary. They'll use less archaic forms. So it'll apply to a number of settings. But like I say, our focus right here are just the people that we sit next to every day. The people that we see at the water cooler, at the lunchroom, that we go on calls with, that we're in meetings with. The people that see the good, the bad, and the ugly of our life. See, because there's an opportunity in the good, the bad, and the ugly. And we'll talk about how you convert each one of those good, bad, and ugly elements into a reality of what Christ is doing. Now the method, how this is supposed to work. Got a couple of verses here. You are our letter, Paul's writing to Corinthians. You are our letter written in our hearts, known and read by all men, being manifested that you are a letter of Christ, cared for by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts. Paul, in context, Paul is talking about there a letter of recommendation. Paul is arguing against some false apostles who had come in and said, Paul is not a real apostle, we are super apostles, and here's our letters of recommendation. They had a resume, they had letters of recommendation from other churches that said we're really good. Paul didn't have this. Paul didn't have letters of recommendation. He didn't carry around a vitae. You know, he didn't have these kinds of things. And so he's talking to the Corinthians. He says, look, you are my letter. I founded your church. You people know me. I preached the gospel to you. I agree. You are my letter of recommendation, and everybody knows it. He says, it's everybody out here. In fact, it's more broad than that, he says. You are a letter of Christ. You are a letter. Christ wrote you out. Less like he wrote the law in the Old Testament that was supposed to show forth the good heart of God and the personal integrity of God. That's what the Corinthians' lives were supposed to be. You're supposed to be a walking gospel tract. See, remember my point about they didn't have literature to leave? Okay, what you left was an impression of your life. Now, I don't know whether I've got it as an exercise or not, but if you think back about the people in your life, think about how you became a believer. Whether you became a believer as somebody in a family, you grew up, mom and dad, or somebody in college got a hold of you, or somebody as child evangelism, or a missionary, or something of this type. Most of us came to Him because we saw one life. We saw somebody that had something that was different enough to authenticate that message. If you grew up in Western culture, you've seen plenty of bad examples of Christians. There was one person, maybe two. I've never known anybody that had more than five of those people that were so sold out and so transformed by the love of God that you either saw it in their lives, they were love, their gentleness, or their happiness, or their peace in circumstances, or their cool-headedness and in all kinds of things. There was just something that stuck out. Not everybody has that. But the vast majority of it passes down that way. In other words, I had mine, junior high counselor. I didn't get saved for another 7 years. 7 years it took before I saw a second one. I saw a second one of those. And, you know, N equals 2, I saw a trend line there. And I could build a pattern out of that and say, yeah, I'm going to take these people seriously. Plenty of crackpots out there. But part of the miracle of salvation is that God helps us forget those in those times where He's dealing with us sometimes. But there are people like that, and that's how it's supposed to work. See, that's why you don't have to have, you know, this isn't a course on the 12 greatest closing techniques for evangelists at the office. Right? This is a class on trying to work on the gospel in your life and how it spills over. And the spilling over has to be put in ways that don't offend people. When you say, I remember a young lady back in the 1970s who had a bumper sticker. It was a campaign, evangelist campaign. There was a bumper sticker. It's called "I Found It." All it had was "I Found It" on the thing. And you were trained that if somebody said, "Well, what did you find?" And you're supposed to bubble up, "I found a new life in Jesus. You want me to tell you about it?" And so she did that in North Miami Beach in the Jewish suburbs. That's where she lived at the time. Right? And we were in Bible college down there. And so she would go to shopping centers, you know, where the car was parked. And you'd get the retired Jewish people from New York would say, "What did you find?" "I found a new life in Jesus Christ. You want me to tell you about it?" And she never got a "yes, please." It was always the other thing, right? And so we've got to learn how to do. There are times to do that. I'm not putting that down, believe me, because there are places where that worked great. It was a great national campaign, and a lot of it. But we're working here on the office context, right? So first one there. The second one was same thing: do everything without complaining or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a crooked and depraved generation, in which you shine like stars in the universe as you hold out the word of life. Not force it down their throats. You hold out the word of life, and you shine like stars in the sky. Right? This is a beauty thing. We're trying to show them Jesus. That's the way it's supposed to work. Let your light shine. Jesus' words in Matthew: let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Okay. So again, this is a matter of living a life in front of people. And the bottom line there is we simply open our life and experience to others. See, that's how this works at the office in relationships, is that we're trying to open up a life that has been changed and understands God. We're trying to let that spill out. Okay, second point under this method is everything, therefore, must be real to you and to your life or from a trusted reference life. Okay, the good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth what is good, and the evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth what is evil. For his mouth speaks from that which fills his heart. So, the point there is Jesus is making the comment is that your words will betray you. In other words, if you put whatever you put in your heart, whatever you guard in there, whatever you treasure in terms of your values and your aspirations, that's going to spill out. That's going to come out. Treasure's going to come out. And that's what we're trying to do, is make sure that we understand our experience of Christ, our experience of God, of these elements, so that they can spill out. Okay, so that's how the method is. We're going to try to clarify our own understandings of this as we go. So, do you personally have examples? Now, this is one of the assignments for you to do later. Do you have examples in your life of unambiguously answered prayer? Okay, so if somebody says, you know, how do you know God is real? How do you know God answers prayer at all? If you do, I have literally 50 sheets of things over the last 25 years called "We Ask, He Answers," or "I Ask, He Answers." And they're prayer requests that are dated, and when I got the answers on the things. So anytime I get really discouraged that God's not going to help me or something like that, I can go back to this audit trail. And make a case, just like the psalmist did. He would rehearse, let's see, "Og, king of Bashan, Sihon, king of the Amorites. We went through the..." Yeah, God's going to be strong for us. Yeah, right, okay. And so I had this audit trail. Now, if you went through those and tried to find those that were things like, "I prayed for a new couch." Okay? Now, and I got a new couch and I put a thanks down there, but if I tried to use that on somebody and I paid for that out of myself on like a Macy's credit card, they would look at me like I'm crazy that God answered that prayer. You did this, Glenn, through your normal means. And the fallback, yeah, but God's the one who allowed me to do this, doesn't carry a whole lot of weight. That's wishful thinking, sociologically speaking, in today's world. Okay, But I've got a couple that fall in this category of unambiguously answered prayer, where the stats, statistics were way against it. There were just no way that the timing was going to happen for this to happen. We don't get tons of these because God doesn't try to scare us a lot with these big, huge miracle things. Okay? He's trying to grow individuals to people a new universe. He's trying to grow people to populate a whole new world in which dwells righteousness. And so he's trying to develop personal integrity, decision-making, thinking, you know, all this kinds of stuff. The fruit of the Spirit, the last one's called what? Self-control. Fruit of the Spirit's love, joy, peace. The last one's called self-control. This is what he's trying to get us to, right? Now, unambiguously prayer. Do you have an example of that? Unambiguous providential circumstances. Do you have situations where something so weird happened, a person came through, an opportunity opened up, something, again, that's just out there. It's harder to explain that. You might could explain it through some other means, but the weight, the evidence and the stats would be against you. See, do you have examples of that? Answered questions that you had before becoming a believer. If you had some problems in life, some questions that just really ate at you. Why would a God of love make mosquitoes? You know, and that just ate you up, tormented you day after. If you got an answer of that later, that's a positive thing. If something resolved out, okay? Answered questions. And crises in which His presence was felt, sensed, and made a difference to your emotional health. Not He solved the problem, but He was there. Big difference. Big difference. Because one of the things we're going to have to avoid here is making promises for God that He doesn't make. Okay? But He has promised to be with us during these periods of difficulty, etc. And there are times, if you've got some times in your life where you've been through this, you know what I'm talking about. It's just a couple of days that you needed somebody there to listen, somebody to be there with you, and where it was strong enough to get you through it without you becoming a total cynic for the rest of your life or making aberrant things, aberrant habit patterns. And so what you'll want to do is to find a couple of these elements in your life that are just unambiguous, where you can focus in. And when somebody says, why? What has He done? When has He ever been for you in a situation like I'm facing? My little sister was just in a car wreck, and she's in this kind of situation. And I don't know what to do. There's a hole in my heart as big as this office. What can your God do in a situation like that? You can't promise that He solves the problems, you know. But the answer of, well, I tell you what He did in a situation like that, but it was involving my older brother or my roommate or my closest friend in life. He was there with me through this. And I was able to cope with it and deal with the people around me and us all grow a little bit through this and get through it. See? And so you need to make sure you've got a couple of those that you've got in your life. That are, again, that's evidence of God's work in your life. See, that's the work of God. That's what He does. That's the net. That's what they call the benefit. I mean, that's what God is trying to do in our lives. So that's some of the things in our heart, and it has to be real to you. Like I say, you don't want to try any of these that won't hold up. If you try popping out, you know, He answers prayers, and I prayed for, you know, that I would grow a little taller. You know, unless you're at my age and you're trying to avoid shrinkage. But at that point, I grow a little taller and I'm an adolescent. You know, that won't carry much, a whole lot of weight. Number three, point three under method. All things to all men. Pick your battles. Pick your battles. You don't want to fight over useless stuff here. This will be hard. Trust me. Paul, for though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, that I might win the more. To the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win the Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those who are without the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. Give no offense either to Jews or to the Greeks or to the church of God. Just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of the many, that they may be saved. Now, the point here is that would Paul like to argue with the Jewish rabbis? He loved this stuff, right? But if it was a situation where there was a chance to get across the message of Christ, you think he would go argue? No. When it came time, when he went to Jerusalem, did he take a vow? Did he offer his little sacrifices as part of the vow? Absolutely. Did he pay for somebody's sacrificial fees? Absolutely. Because he knew that they were useless. They were meaningless. They did not give offense. They did not give offense. He knew it wasn't a compromise. If he went back and did the big, Day of Atonement thing, that might have been an issue. That might have been an issue. He might would have had to draw the line there. But in just observant of Sabbath and the holidays, if they wanted to make an issue of it, he did. If they didn't make an issue of it, it wasn't a problem. In other words, he picked his battles. And one of your challenges on this in the office is always going to be this, because there are so many causes and there's so many arguments that will pop up about values and about families, and you'll be tempted to go in there and sit there and fight and say, no, this is the only political party, this is the only football team, I don't know. The kinds of thing, maybe football teams are a little extreme, but political parties are candidates or points of view or ideologies, ways of government, forms of government, things of this type. And the problem is there, you got to decide whether you want to alienate people for that or for something else. See, there are times that you just participate in that life, but there are times if you think you're going to alienate everybody else, you're not sure you want to fight that one. If you want to fight something worth fighting for. I remember my first pastor told me in the first 6 months of our relationship as a college, he said, one of the first things you need to do, Glenn, are decide what 5 to 6 things you'll take a bullet for in a firing line. What doctrines, what beliefs in the Scripture that you'd be willing to die for. And then you focus on those. Don't quibble about the other stuff. Don't quibble about the other stuff. You pick the things that are really important, and those are what you want to fight about. And this will be a challenge of learning to be flexible, because being all things to all people doesn't mean, okay, going into illicit activities with them, so you can witness to them there, you know, at the strip joint or something of this type. But you are going to have this, and this is an interesting challenge because you're going to have to interact with these people on a regular basis. All things to all, pick your battles. 4 is an open life. Now, this is going to be hard for many of us. Some of us have cultural biases that say you don't open up, you don't share. Sometimes it's gender stereotyping, sometimes it's Western civ, sometimes it's rugged individualism. There are various stereotypes. Vulnerability is a fearful thing, generally. And that's sort of what we're getting to here. We're sort of getting to an openness. And letting them see your doubts and struggles and wins. Because, see, our normal assumption is that they have to see the bright things about the faith. And not the fact that we're like the psalmist. We're always under something. I mean, the number of triumphant, psalms to overdose of, God help! I'm being crushed by this. It's a very bad ratio. It's a real discouraging ratio. Let's put it this way, right? But this is where life is. And a God that's not there is only a part-time God. He's only there when you're celebrating, see? And so, a couple of examples of showing you about the openness. Here's how Jesus modeled this. When Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane the night before he died, said to his disciples, sit here while I go over yonder to pray. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be grieved and distressed. And he said to them, my soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch with me. Okay. Now my soul has become troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this purpose I came into this hour. So here we see Jesus, Son of God, right, hurting, and opens that up to these calloused fishermen of Galilee. Didn't stop him at all. He said, I'm hurting. I need a friend here. Just stay here and watch with me, please. My soul is distressed. He opened up. He was very, very straightforward about the pressures on him in his particular role. Paul's no different. He's perhaps a little more verbose about his. Therefore, I am all the more eager to send him, so that when you see him again, my soul may be glad, and I may have less anxiety. Not that I won't have any anxiety, that I'll just have a little less. I got a few less stresses in my life once you see him. For out of much affliction and anguish of heart, he's honest about that, I wrote to you with many tears, not that you should be grieved, but that you might know the love which I have more abundantly to you. He's being disclosive about his hassles. When we came to Macedonia, this body of ours had no rest, but we were harassed at every turn. Conflicts on the outside, fears within. But God, who comforts the downcast, comforted us by the coming of Titus. And see, this will be part of your message, is that I'm hurting, but God's here with me. I have been hurting, and God has been there with me. He comforted me. there were times. And that's part of the message, is that we're going to open our life up. And then I just mentioned the model of the Psalms. I don't even have any quotes from that because I didn't have the 34 pages to print out all the quotes for that. Okay? Now, the next one is another challenge we'll have called caring but not best buddies. Okay? And let me just point, this is where you're going to hang out with them, okay, but you're not going to do all the wrong things they do in the name of hanging out with him. We just got ourselves into a world of trouble trying to decide between those two, if you think about it. We'll talk about some special cases about business ethics and dirty jokes and things of this type as we get into the pragmatics. But one of the challenges we're going to have is that we have to build close relationships with some of these, or as close as that. Let's look at the passages here. 1 Peter, for you have spent enough time in the past doing what the pagans choose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing in detestable idolatry. They think it strange that you do not plunge with them into the same flood of dissipation and the heap of abuse on you. So here are the pagans, and they don't understand why they wouldn't go do these things, why the Christians wouldn't do these things. Christians seem to be happy enough. Where was the happiness coming from? It wasn't come from hanging out with us in the little what stuff we were doing. And they think, why? What's wrong with this? How can that possibly be wrong? See? And they won't have the same ethical grid that you will have and that God's developing in us in many, many cases. And so we'll have to be aware that they're going to heap abuse on us because we won't do some things. Now, don't go overboard with this. I mean, it's just way too easy to sit there and say, well, I'm never going to, I'm never going to wear a shirt that's part cotton and part polyester because the Old Testament law about not weaving with two fabrics together. And so this is my stand for God, and so I'm going to apply the law in this way and make it public. So don't even ask me to go to a store that sells that things with. And that's a facetious overkill. And we have a second verse here from Proverbs. Do not make friends with a hot-tempered man. Do not associate with one easily angered. You may learn his ways and get yourself in snare. Okay? And there was some of this stuff. There's an old saying that you are not what you eat, but you are who you eat with. The people that you hang out with, sometimes you have to love and you have to be discriminating about this, but you have to judge behavior that you don't consider. Not to them, by the way. You don't sit there and say, oh, that's just really gross. You internally, as it pops up, you say, well, I can't go there inside. I can't think that way, feel that way, go participate in that. And so the way of keeping it from becoming part of your character, by the way, practical-wise, is to judge it inside. Take a distancing inside quietly to yourself and distance from it, and that way it won't soak in. If you don't do that, it just literally comes across, the good and the bad and the ugly comes across. So that's just a practical thing in sanctification, even though this is not a class on sanctification per se. Okay. Now, the opposite is here's what Jesus did. Okay. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking. And you say, behold, a gluttonous man and a drunkard, a friend of tax gatherers and sinners. It came about that he was reclining at the table in his house, and many tax gatherers and sinners were dining with Jesus and his disciples. For there were many of them, and they were following him. And when the scribes of the Pharisees saw that he was eating with the sinners and tax gatherers, they began saying to his disciples, why is he eating and drinking with tax gatherers and sinners? So he didn't distance himself. One of the differences between the Pharisees of Jesus' day and Jesus was over what they called table fellowship. In other words, when you offered table fellowship, you sat and dined with somebody, it was more of a religious thing than just purely social. You said that they were worth something. Okay, because the Pharisees would not sit with shepherds and tax collectors, etc. They could not eat with them. It was unclean. It was against their religion to hang out with these people. Okay, Jesus sat with them. That didn't mean he became a tax collector or practiced prostitution. See? But the fact that he would, in a formal setting, have dinner with these people and celebrate with them just the goodness of God in life, is where that difference is. And like I say, that's a challenge to know in an office setting or in a relationship setting sometimes when it's appropriate and when it's not. You have to just trust the Lord and go there. But you can't distance like the Pharisees or there'll be nobody to reach. There'll be nobody in the office to talk with. Paul says specifically, he told them to expel an immoral brother. There, in 1 Corinthians, there's a brother that's having a sexual relationship with his mother-in-law. And he said, that's not right for a believer to be having sexual relationships with his mother-in-law. That's, kick him out. Yes, I mean, just let him know that that's unapproved behavior. Excommunicate him from the church. Maybe he'll come around, we'll bring him back in. But kick him out. Then in the second letter, he said, now, you misunderstood. I don't mean don't hang out with anybody that acts that way, or else you need to leave the world. Okay? I'm just talking about Christians that are not supposed to act like that. Okay? So what we've got in this point about caring is that we still have to hang out with these people. Okay? And daily course of life, but just watch picking up the bad characteristics in those kinds of things. Six is opportunities, which has to do with we're going to focus on trying to find opportunities in which to develop a conversation about Christ. Okay, so we're going to look for opportunities to start weaving the words of Jesus and the work of Jesus into those conversations. And the opportunities, I've got four categories of opportunities. Some people make opportunities. There are more than enough just hanging around because of the way the world works. So the four categories I've got here are the first one, of course, they're felt needs. So you've got an office worker that's anxious, extremely anxious, not just a good obsessive-compulsive kind of anxiety, but something deeper than that. Discouragement, disillusionment, alienation, and this is sort of an attitude kind of thing. I mean, this you've seen them, it's something that they've slipped into and it's become chronic. It's part of their life now. It's not just an episodic thing. Be their current crises, which are events. We're going to have to take a break in about 2 or 3 minutes here. Current crises, troubles at home, illness, finances, things that get our attention in life, things that make us generally back up and reflect upon bigger picture issues, things of this type. We'll talk about the events. Reflecting on their past crises, when they're through with it, if you are friends with someone, you can ask this kind of question. So what's the most life-changing experience you've had? Then they talk. And you say, how did that affect the way you see life or family or even God? See? And what you do is you're taking a past crisis and getting them to reflect upon this in terms of how it changed their perspective on some bigger issues like family, life, and God. Okay? And you're converting a past opportunity into a present opportunity. And then D, which is your current crisis. In other words, whatever you're having trouble with. If you've got some kind of crisis going on in your life, or you're feeling alienated, or things of this type yourself, this becomes an opportunity to develop a conversation. And so these are built around felt needs, where people are. It's not like broadcast evangelism where you're interrupting their life to bring you this message of Jesus. You know, this is literally flowing out of our lives. Okay, we're at point seven. And seven is not a conspiracy. Okay, and this is, don't make this look like a setup or a trap, okay, for these people. I give an example there about Bibles with their names already engraved on them in your office. So you've already got, literature locked, loaded, and aimed at their cubbyhole, right, kind of thing. And the interesting thing about this is that one of your assignments will be to find five people in your office setting that you interact with. And there is that element of targeting. There is that element of that this is somebody I do want to get the message to. And what it cannot do is distance you from them as human beings, as co-workers. Because, like I say, it's one beggar telling another beggar where to find bread. So even though you can sit here and plot ways to do this, you always have to watch that, because the answer is always, anytime I get into a conspiracy, specifically with my kids, okay, when I'm dealing with my children in this and trying to nurture them in their faith, it's so, as a dad, it's so hard to avoid the manipulation thing, right? So at Christmas, you pay them to read religious literature so they can earn money to buy their Christmas presents, right? I do this as a habit, and it had a secondary motive. Right, a secondary motive, so they know all there is to know about certain things, right? And there's a fine line between manipulation and just literally sharing, and trying to not get in the way of God's work. And that's what we're trying to do here, not a conspiracy. Don't make it look like a setup. This is not an evangelistic campaign like Joe and Joan. You're not out to do this. You're out to share. You're holding forth the word of life. You're trying to look at opportunities when they come up, be sensitive to what God is doing. Okay? We're not in a campaign kind of model. And the final point there is that this needs to be an integral part of who we are, not an add-on. Okay? This is not an attachment to what we do. During the next 10 weeks, it, depending upon how much of this you've done, it will feel that way as you start thinking about these ways. It'll feel odd. And eventually, it'll become more and more just second nature that you'll think in terms of this. You'll find ways of putting this in the conversation, and when you get a bite, great. Right? But it becomes part of who you are. We'll talk about weaving the Lord's, ascription to the Lord, talking about the Lord in just daily conversations. When is it overkill and when is it not? When is it okay to use a reference to God, in a casual conversation? We'll talk about some of those dynamics. And I've got plenty of examples here. And what you won't want to do is be consciously trying to do this at every single conversation. See, where you've got to slip the gospel in here every conversation. Because remember, you're showing. This is a showing thing. You're just going to live it. Because you have enough problems as it is living it. Right? Without diverting attention from being righteous to appearing righteous. So it's always, when you look at it from a conspiracy standpoint, that this has to just flow out of who you are. Right? When you go to the grocery store, you're not going to the grocery store, or to the lunchroom rather, in this context, you're not going to the lunchroom to share the gospel. You're going to eat lunch. Okay? You're going with somebody. Maybe they've asked you to tell you their story. Maybe. Maybe there'll be an opportunity to mention something about what God's done or some crisis that you're facing. Okay? But this is not an evangelistic campaign. You just got to make sure that this is in the life. This is not supposed to be scary stuff. See, this is supposed to be focused and just an outflowing of love. We're trying to learn how to just do this better than we've been doing it before, basically. Okay? 8, lawfully, decently, and in order. In the context of social group rules. Okay? The first one is rules of appropriateness for your office setting. Wearing a sandwich board to the cafeteria, is that appropriate in most of our offices, like out here in Silicon Valley? Probably not. Probably would be inappropriate. It would be seen wrong. Gospel tracts on the top of toilets. That works in executive red carpet clubs when I'm traveling through airports. But it wouldn't work in my office setting back on Zanka Road, for example. Okay, may or may not. Okay, but generally, a lot of times it's not. Shouting on the subway. I've ridden in New York subways, Chicago L, and London L, and there's always been some in that case up there just shouting out their Pin or Perish message, every fourth or fifth car. And I keep thinking, Jesus, take another hit here, another hit here, another hit here. If I try to share the gospel, yeah, I know. I heard all about this from this guy. Yeah, right, up on the car 54. Where are you, right? So you have to. This is done lawfully, decently, and in order. Appropriateness. B, respect. You are a guest of somebody at that office. Even if you're an employee, work for hire or not, you are a guest there. And you, if they want you to take your shoes off, when you go in that house, you take them off. That's not a religious issue. And we're trying to do this in the context of what is appropriate and what's not appropriate. We have this thing called the offense of the message, that the message of the cross is offensive. It strikes, but it is offensive to the proud. And we'll look at specifically, it is not offensive to the poor. Believe me. It is not offensive. It's good news. But to the proud, the arrogant that want to do it, it is highly offensive. And it was always offensive to Paul's elite groups that he targeted. But there are two phrases, and they talk about the offense of the message or the offense of the cross, as Paul calls it. And I've got two characters called the offense of the messenger. This is where I'm offensive as the messenger. Either I didn't take my daily breath mints, or I have inappropriate kinds of work habits, and I'm offensive, me, before we even get to the message, are then what I call the offense of the really cross. People that are abusive. People that are belligerent sharing the gospel. Not just the offense of the cross, but of the really cross. These are the things that we're trying to avoid. If you were in a culture, by the way, where cross was okay, if you lived in gospel times, first century Judaism, where the rabbis were always in one another's face calling one another broods of vipers. And Moses did it, and Isaiah did it, and Ezekiel did it. They were calling each other, all the fellow Jews, broods of vipers, and you guys are just fools, and all this kind of stuff. It's perfectly appropriate to get up and rip somebody's face off. Because it's an act of love in that culture. It's the way they lived. If I take some of the words of Jesus in that culture and put them over, in at least Northern California, I'm going to get sued. I'm going to get a lawsuit, you know, for that kind of behavior. See what I'm saying? So it's culturally sensitive as to how you present it, how it's important to do. And remember, wisdom is peace-loving. We're after peace and gentility here. Okay? We've got another issue here that I think I'm going to read through, and this is... You won't get this if you do this right. This is called when ordered by the boss to cease and desist. So, if you share the gospel sometimes, maybe not this way, but in past ways, perhaps the boss has had to call you aside. That's happened to me once. And said, Glenn, you're being a little too evangelistic here. You're turning people off. This is some 20 years ago. Can you tone it down a bit? This kind of thing. Cease and desist. And what you've got here is, I've got a passage here from Acts where the Pharisees told the apostles to stop preaching about Jesus. And what shall we do with these men for the fact that the Pharisees are talking among themselves, the Sanhedrin, Pharisees and elders. What shall we do with these men? For the fact that a noteworthy miracle has taken place through them is apparent to all who live in Jerusalem, and we cannot deny it. But in order that it may not spread any further, this teaching about Jesus, among the people, let us warn them to speak no more to any man in his name. And when they had summoned them, they commanded them not to speak or teach at all in the name of Jesus. But Peter and John answered them and said to them, whether it's right in the sight of God to give heed to you rather than to God, you be the judge. For we cannot stop speaking what we have seen and heard. All right, now here's what we call civil disobedience. Okay? The religious authorities said, stop. And they said, how are we going to do this? And so there's a time where you say, no, I can't. But most of the times, we won't run across this in the office. And if you get into a cease and desist, the first thing you need to look at are these first two points. First, make dead sure you're not being pushy, abrasive, or inappropriate. If you are, then the cease and desist makes sense. Take that as a clue from God. Tap on the shoulder to wake up and review the material on gentleness, wisdom, peace, loving. Okay? Secondly, do not appeal to free speech rights. Okay? Every other cult in the world can do this and get away with it. Okay? Because we expect it of cults to do this in the office and the airports. The first chance a Judeo-Christian message, you do free speech, the boss checks out. The boss checks out, man. You don't come across as love. I mean, you don't come across as human anymore. So it's legitimate, you know, at a technical level, but this is Paul fighting over a fine point with somebody. Instead, I hear a couple of other ways. If you're not being abrasive, abusive, or those kinds of things, here's a couple of different sayings that I've got about cease and desist. Boss, you know, I never push anything on anybody, especially my personal views of life. Like I said, make sure that's true. Okay? Why would you think I would do this? Second example, boss, you know as well as I do that I don't try to push my religion on people here. Good grief. If someone asks me what I think and believe about politics, family, life, or God, I give them a simple and honest answer. What am I supposed to tell them? Sorry, the boss won't let me answer you about this. Now, notice you'll see me consistently through here put God in with family and with values. In some cases, politics. Okay? Because they fall in that spectrum of deeper things, important values. And so people won't judge you about discussing about the way you feel about a family, your family, or political or ethical stances. But somehow God doesn't fit in that. And if you keep putting those together, remember that first quote that I gave you about how has this changed your perspective on family life or even God? See, you want them to start seeing those together by association in your life. It's part of family life. It's part of values. It's part of just life. It's not some religious detachment. Okay, so that's a case where I give that there. Boss, third one. Boss, I don't understand. I need you to help me on this. If you and I were having a private lunch and I ask you what you believed about morality and politics, how would you answer me? If I ask you about what were your personal priorities in life, how would you answer me? If I ask you what your personal views about God and religion were, how would you answer me? then how is that different from what am I doing here? When someone asks me the same questions. See, what we're just trying to do is show that the life that we're trying to live is ordinary. This is not weirdness. This is just normal life that's going on, normal conversations. And then there's the last one, boss, there's something odd about this request. That pushy stuff is not my style at all. Make sure it's not. You may be a confrontational manager. This may be you're winning through intimidation. You just recently read that book, you know, and you're practicing that out. But if it's not your style, you know that. So how many people are complaining about me to you? Just one? Normally, it will be just one. Okay, it will be one heckler, one anti-God, anti-Christian, and anybody that's associated with those movements. Just one. Why do you think it's just him or her? Is he overly sensitive or something? I can certainly do my best to avoid any non-business conversation around that person, but I don't think it's the least bit inappropriate to discuss the subject briefly and carefully with other associates to bring it up. Again, you're just trying to make it look like ordinary life. Okay? And the last point before we go to a section here is on wisdom and gentleness. And this sums up sort of this method thing. Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation always be full of grace. Okay, now, I don't know about your views of grace, but if you try to visualize grace, to me it's flowing form, it's gentleness. Grace is like a river. It's pictured, it's liquid form. It goes around corners. It doesn't abrade them. It's not like comet cleansers. Okay, it goes around. It's fluid, it's graceful. Literally where we get the word, graceful. Let your conversation be full of sweetness. And then James, but the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. The first thing about wisdom there is that it's pure. In other words, you don't lie about this stuff. You don't make up answers to problems you don't have. You don't tell about experiences that you had that you haven't had. You don't talk about answered prayers that weren't. You know, it's truthful. It's pure. It says, I don't know, when you get a problem that you don't know. It doesn't try to bluff its way. It's pure. The second characteristic after it's truthful is it's peace-loving. It doesn't create... One of the things you'll see us say down here is, and I've used this myself in different settings, you know, I would rather do anything than make you feel uncomfortable, Joan. I don't want to do anything to make you feel uncomfortable. But at the risk of doing that, let me encourage you to take a fresh, non-churchy look at Jesus. Just friend to friend. I don't want to make you uncomfortable. I know this will, just because that word does it. But at the risk of doing that, let me just encourage you to take a fresh, non-churchy look at the Jesus of the Bible. See, it was, I'm aware in that statement that I'm going to make that person nervous. And I'm defusing that, trying to defuse, making them less nervous by me making it explicit that I know what's going to make them nervous. See? And that's what we're talking about here about peace-loving. It's considered. It knows what they're going to balk at. It knows what they're nervous about. It's submissive. It's after their goals. It's after their good. I'm not scalp hunting. I don't want to come back to church and say, I nailed 5 people for Jesus this week. Right? This is where you put somebody else's welfare full of mercy. It cuts them tons of slack. Tons of slack. We'll talk about this about abusive behavior and good fruit. It has a life. It shows this. It's full of that. It's impartial and it's sincere. Very, very sincere. Yes, sir?
Great. Attracted me to Christianity years ago. I read it where he said that so many people are so quick to tell you how many people went to Christ, but they don't want to tell you how many people they drove away by their
religion. Boy, that's a great quote. That's a great quote. Right. People will tell you how many they won, but they won't tell you how many they drove away by that. That's a great quote. Thanks for sharing that, friend. Absolutely. Okay. Now we're through with this. Let's go back to the back. Now I got to read your exercises for next week. So at the back of that, or maybe it's a separate handout, you've got your homework. And for next week, we've got 5 assignments and a term paper. No, we don't have a term paper. Just kidding about that. I don't want your work to fall out to where you're unemployed by this time next week because of the assignments. But let's look at the first 5 assignments. Just read through them, make sure we're clear on them. And these are personal ones. I mean, these are things you do and perhaps put it in your binder. The first one is assignment one. Describe briefly a couple of your experiences at sharing your faith. And that's broadly considered. That's even just mentioning God or telling people that you go to church or anything that's going to attract attention. Let's put it this way. Sharing your faith, both at work or in other areas of your life. Okay? Family, whatever. For each one of those experiences, just a couple, describe your motivation, what actually triggered the sharing event. In other words, what kind of opportunity, what brought that about? What was the outcome? How did it turn out? Good things about the experience, bad things about it, and whatever happened to that person. In other words, did we drive them away? Did they become interested? Things of this type. Then describe a couple of times you wanted to share with a coworker but didn't. Okay? Include the description, what the situation was, what you felt at that time, what you wanted to say, and what stopped you from saying it. Okay, and what would have helped you to actually say it? Was it training on how to say it? Had you had them alone as opposed to in a group? Would that have facilitated it? Or just less fear? Or those kinds of things. Try to look at how you approach this. Goal two is make a list of the most vivid instances of the Lord's interaction in your life. Instances that you would find difficult to account for in any other way. Remember, we were talking about those unambiguous answered prayer. Okay, try to at least one very specific answered prayer, one very specific case of providential event, and one very specific instance of where you sensed His presence in times of difficulty, with the result that you were strengthened and enabled to get through it. Just pick one of each one of those that will build into your story. Assignment three, and this will be our list, make a list of five coworkers, four or five, that you interact with most frequently. List their name, job title, how they relate to you on an org chart, how long you have known them, any interest they have, your guess as to their religious background, how frequently you interact with them, and any crises or major stress events in their lives that you know of. We will refer to this list of coworkers in future lists as the starter list. Okay, we're just going to just pick four or five people and start building a list of these people, because we're going to apply other things to them as we come through this. Four, think about your business environment. Try to visualize three to four inappropriate ways of sharing. Our little sandwich board, I've already given you a clue there. That may not be appropriate. Sharing your faith there. Then reflect back on the people who were most influential in your spiritual journey. Okay, I understand you have to go. What did they do? What did they say? How did they communicate credibility to you? How did they communicate love and care for you? How did they bring the subject up? Okay, you're trying to do an autopsy of what worked in your life. What was important to you? What did you respond to from your life? And then goal five is write up your own personalized version of cease and desist conversation with your boss. If it's conceivable that you would ever get one of those, just write up your own little version of maybe one of those four as to what you could say, assuming that it wasn't your fault. Let's put it this way. Okay? The only other piece of assignment I want you to look at between now and next week is on those little handouts, was the when you're ready to take your first step toward God. Okay? It has people come to this, I think I'm ready step for many different reasons. And I get about seven or eight different categories. And look through those and be thinking about your experience and coworkers that you know. How many of them fit in these categories? How many of them you know are facing a crisis? Not beyond the list of four or five. I mean, just people that you know, maybe even that you don't have interaction with. But start thinking in terms of these are the various reasons that people get ready to approach God that I know of. There may be more than this, of course. Okay, but these are ones that I have seen where people are ready to approach God because of this, that, and the other. And be thinking in terms of these, because humans fall into this greed. See, we're there now. Most believers, see, are here as God's trying to develop things in our life. He'll have us into some of these things. We'll have an addiction problem. We'll have a crisis problem. We'll see other Christians that have things in their lives that we still want, even though we've been Christians 25 years. You know, we still would have like to have more of that or more of that or more of that, right? And so also take a look at that one for next week. Let's close in a word of prayer. I went over because I think we got a late start. But Father, we thank You for Your love. We thank You for Your patience with us, Your gentleness with us, and that You broke through the fog into our lives and nurtured us into the arms of your Son. We thank you so much for your patience with us, and that your love is the real thing here, that we love people, that we love one another, and that love shows forth the work of Christ in our hearts. We just pray that you'd help us to develop this just a little bit more through the next couple of weeks, as we can just expand our hearts in these areas a little bit, Lord. And help us not be an add-on. Help us just sort of be part of us at different rates for where we are in our lives, and help us feel comfortable with this. And help us get to know you better in this process, and give us a glimpse of the way you see people, including us, through your good heart. Bring us safely back together again next week. For your Son's sake, we pray. Amen.